nobody really gives you a roadmap for how to become famous. And people are giving them drugs and alcohol, and it's just hard to hold it together. So I think one thing that every story in this book has in common is that, like, I don't think anybody dealt with that transition very well.
That is the voice of rock author Dan Ozzie, whose book Sellout is just fascinating. It chronicles the rise of many bands in the early 90s and beyond, bands like Green Day and Jimmy Eat World, and talks about an era in the rock and roll industry, not just the record industry, but rock and roll, that might never be repeated. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll music. And today we venture a little out of our comfort zone. You know, generally we like to look at FM radio in the 70s and 80s, maybe a little earlier, maybe a little later. We talk about bands from those times, but today we move forward to the 90s and into the 2000s, talking about bands, as I said, like Green Day and Jimmy Eat World and many others. And it's interesting to hear Dan recount how these bands adapted, you know, adapted to stardom, adapted to millions of dollars, adapted to drugs and alcohol. It reminds me of a funny quote from Ted Nugent. It goes something like this. He said he never got into rock and roll for the girls, but he adapted. So just a reminder, before we get to our conversation with Dan Ozzie, you can follow us, subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Stitcher. Give us a review and share us with your friends. Tell a friend about us. That would be great. So without further ado, let's get to our rock conversation with Dan Ozzie.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
Sellout. A lot of people think when you say sellout, it's derogatory and it's a bad mark. I actually think sometimes it's a good term. If someone's sold out, maybe they're going to another level. When you started writing this book, how did you view the term sellout?
I've never thought of it in that context as a positive. I've only heard it in a derogatory manner. It's weird because the word has a lot of, you know, like a long history, and there's almost like instances where there's like racial connotations behind it. But for me, growing up and liking the kind of music that I did, I learned it as essentially like a punk slur, you know, that you would try to delegitimize somebody's credibility with.
What would happen, though, if these bands did not, quote unquote, sell out? A lot of us would never have heard them.
Yeah, sure. Maybe it would have been somebody else who was lesser or greater. I don't know. But yeah, a lot of them, if they didn't take that chance, although I don't know, like, you know, a lot. One band that I didn't get to too much in my book, but is sort of like the exception to the rule, was The Offspring, who did stay indie, and I believe sold more copies for an independent label than any other album in history, with Smash on Epitaph Records. But that to me seems like the rare fluke, you know.
Without question. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dan Ozzie. He's the author of Sellout, just out. I encourage you to check out the book. It's fantastic. I'm going to run the gamut somewhat quickly on a lot of these topics. You start with Green Day, which I think is natural given their incredible success. One anecdote that I found really interesting, if I remember it correctly, is they were living together in a house in the East Bay area, and limos would pull up almost on a daily basis. And I'll let you expand upon the story there. Who was in those limos and what were they bringing?
Yeah, that was sort of like from the people I talked to, sort of like Berkeley area lore, you know, maybe it was like exaggerated or maybe not, but people in the area, like punk kids in the area, definitely were aware that Green Day was getting some attention. And there were like rumors going around that, like, yeah, there were limos parked out front of their house, and maybe that was just, you know, their community's way of ribbing them a little bit. But you know, the guy Rob Cavallo, who did sign them, he didn't take a limo, but he certainly did come to their house to meet them and like get to know them, and that is where that, you know, official meeting went down, at their place on Ashby in Berkeley.
this is at a time, and I think a lot of us might forget, where we either did not have MP3s, you know, especially at the start of your book with 94, or they weren't as prominent. And that meant there was still a lot of money to be made in the music business. And I think you highlight that throughout the book. Tell us what was involved for these bands when, you know, here they're almost rags to riches, a number of them.
Well, you know, for sometimes, yes. But for Green Day, I mean, when you think about it, Green Day was probably doing pretty well for a bunch of 21-year-olds because they were on Lookout Records, which had a famously generous 60-40 to artists split on all copies sold. And, you know, they were selling 30,000, 40,000 copies of their record Kerplunk. And, you know, so doing the math on a $10 CD, they were probably getting a decent amount of money from their record label. However, where they ran into problems was that they were growing so fast that their label could not get enough albums to stores. You know, they were just a bedroom operation. And so, yeah, Green Day was making enough at that time to live decently for punk kids, but they were leaving literally millions of dollars on the table by not having their stores more widely, their albums more widely available in stores.
We often hear stories, and rightly so, because I think they're accurate, of bands that get screwed. You know, they don't get legal advice. They rush to sign a contract. They realize only later, if they make it big, that the contract is generally weighted against them and for the record company. You point out, and you alluded to it, that they had a pretty good deal with their initial label. And in this case, it sounds like the initial label and its owner, you know, even after Green Day left, he did okay, because as they got bigger, so did he and his label.
Yeah, I mean, Dookie was sort of like the rising tide that raised
absolutely.
All boats.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't, absolutely Lookout did a lot better for the next year because Green Day was so famous and selling so many copies that just the windfalls, you know, they had two records on Lookout and those sold. But not only that, but people had more interest in what else the label did, Operation Ivy and all this other stuff. But then also too, like a lot of other small indie labels started at that time, or ones that had started were doing pretty well. Fat Records is an example, you know, like kids were getting into this sort of like poppy punk sound, and Fat Record had a whole roster of like No Use for a Name and Lagwagon and all these bands that, you know, just a year ago were like kind of grinding and now selling maybe 100,000 copies of their record, like 200,000 copies of the record. It was definitely like a trickle-down effect from them.
Let's flash back to about 20 years prior with the kind of the first wave of punk, both here and in England. Unfair question, but how would you compare the two waves?
Well, the first one was the punk's like first brush with commercial success was actually quite short-lived. I mean, it was just a couple of years and really not that many bands in the mega stratosphere, right? Ramones, Clash, Sex Pistols, a couple others on the periphery, you know? But it was short-lived and then it died out, and it was a new phenomena at the time. So once it kind of like disappeared from mainstream culture, people were able to ignore it fairly easily. The time that I document in my book, I think was like a little bit longer standing, and it morphed in a lot of ways. Like, you know, Green Day had this sort of like mutated version of punk, this like very melodic pop sound to their like punk roots. And then for the next 2 years, there was like a hunt for stuff like that. And bands like All got signed and bands like Sam I Am got signed. But then after that sort of died down, it's, you know, like even like ska was sort of had like a moment with Less Than Jake and Real Big Fish. And then after that, you know, it kind of like went into this new mutated form of like hardcore and emo and post-hardcore, and you had bands like Thursday and My Chemical Romance, which I think you could trace back to the interest in Green Day. So that was more of like in the 70s, I would describe that more as like an explosion, and explosions are very bright and very fast.
Sure.
This one had a longer tail on it, I would say.
Dan Ozzie is our guest. He is the author of the new book, Sellout. I highly recommend it. Going back to the 70s, the flash, as you say, was there an element of the times that differed? And that's why it was so short. Were the people, the listeners, the consumers excited about it for a short period of time and then they got bored? Or was it a situation where the record companies weren't making the money and they got bored without making money? What was the reason for the brevity of that period?
It is a little bit of what you, all of the things that you mentioned, but one other factor is that a couple of the genre's greatest faces, you know, died.
Yeah.
Sid Vicious and Darby Crash. I'm sure that was sobering, but also too, at that time, punk was very new. And I think that once it hit its limit as far as growth, people assumed that it was over. Like, okay, we had this fad. But I think as time went on over the 80s and 90s, people were looking at more of like, what can we do with this? And over the 80s, that's how like hardcore started up. And then later in the 90s, like emo. And so I really think that in the 70s, it did kind of hit its limit as far as what the public was interested in. Like, we get it. It's fast yeah. Songs. They're 2 minutes. Got it. And then they kind of moved on to the next thing.
And I really hadn't given it much thought, what I'm about to say, before our interview. In fact, before just now, it's somewhat ironic, and our regular listeners know I love irony. But, you know, we will look at a number of different components here on the podcast, Rock Conversations. And one of them is what I call the halcyon days of FM radio, 70s and 80s. And the ironic part, as I finally get to it here, is that those bands like the Ramones, the Clash, to some extent, maybe the Sex Pistols, they actually live on, not so much from the radio of those days, but from the so-called classic rock days or classic rock radio of today. So while it was, the explosion was brief, the longevity over time, at least with the radio, has been quite extensive.
Yeah, but again, we're talking about just a very small number of bands that were almost like flukes. Like, we remember, like, in a classic rock station, we'll put, you know, Blitzkrieg Bop on, and we'll put Should I Stay or Should I Go, maybe a Patti Smith song. But beyond that, like, what from that era really gets added to the rock canon? It's very small.
It is.
And we basically have just a few successful singles from punk's explosion representing that entire era.
So let's go back to your book in the era that you write about. I know the answer to this because I read it, but I'm going to let you tell our listeners, why did you write the book? I find it very interesting.
Why did I write? I wrote it because I lived through it, essentially. You know, I don't put myself in the book at all, but certainly I see myself in it. You know, like, this is the era that, like, Green Day was one of the first bands that really spoke to me as a young person. And then I went down that road and started following these other bands. And I was one of those kids that got angry about the financial decisions that my favorite bands made, you know, because it sometimes felt alienating. You'd find a band that you really connected with and you felt like you had this intimate relationship with them, as corny as that sounds. And then they make this big decision to go to a corporation and it feels like you lose them a little bit, you know? And so these kinds of conversations about major labels versus indies and selling out and, Green Day, and these are all things that I remember and like really dictated the kinds of conversations that I remember happening around me in my teenage years when I was getting into this kind of music.
I think I also read, maybe on your website or elsewhere, that you couldn't find a book about this era. And that's one of the reasons you decided to write it. That's why I was kind of getting at. And I thought it was fascinating.
That too. Yeah. I mean, like, I felt very uniquely equipped to cover this area. Because like you said, like, I'm a big like rock book reader. But whenever I go into a store, you go to like Barnes & Noble or whatever, and you look at what music books they have, and anything that's like representing punk, it's usually something about, like you said, the 70s, you know, a lot of books about the Sex Pistols and stuff. And then maybe in the 80s, you can find one about hardcore, depending on what store you're in. But the era that I lived in, which was huge in terms of sales. I mean, like even just Green Day alone selling millions of copies, it's such a big scene, but I never see the era captured. I've never seen it. And I'm always like, I would read that book. And then one day I just thought that should be me. Maybe I should write that book. And so, yeah, that was kind of the impetus for writing it for sure. I just wanted to see it exist.
Sellout is the name of the book. Dan Ozzie is our guest. He is the author. I want to go back to what you said, because I follow bands, but not as closely from their genesis on through. Usually I pick them up once they've become popular. I'll admit it. I'm not, you know, I'm past that age where I'm going out and checking out new acts. Okay. So I've never really experienced kind of that feeling that you alluded to earlier about being disappointed, betrayed, whatever the phrase or the word may be, when a band goes big after you followed them. Can you elaborate a little more on that?
Yeah, I'll elaborate with an example. You know, Jimmy Eat World is in my book, and Jimmy Eat World had very humble beginnings. You know, they were just kids from Arizona, and they were just 18 and really had a very small following, and then started to get a little bit of attention in the like underground emo scene. And that's when I found them, when they had that album Clarity, which I still think is probably one of the greatest albums ever recorded. And, you know, they had like a cult following, and I felt among it. And then I remember Bleed American came out, and they had this very crazy overnight success, because The Middle became a like a top 10 radio single. And I remember I went to see them at the Allentown Fairgrounds that summer, and it was like 10 times as many people as the last time I'd seen them. And the frustrating part, just as a young person watching music, was that, you know, they were playing songs from Clarity and nobody around me knew them. And I was so frustrated by that as a kid, being like, why don't people know this genius album? And then The Middle would come on and people would go crazy. And it was just almost so frustrating, because this is a very young person's mentality, but you just think, oh, nobody appreciates them the way I do. And in a way, it feels like it like becomes less special to you somehow. It almost feels like they belong to the world now. And you know, obviously, like in hindsight, as an adult, I can look back and think like, yeah, it was selfish to sort of like want to hold a band back. I'm sure they have bills to pay, and I didn't think of that as an 18-year-old. But on a personal level, like that's kind of what it felt like. It felt like losing a band to the world in a way, and it became somehow less special.
Here's another thing where we might differ, being, you know, slightly different from slightly different generations. You know, you're not that totally that young. I'm not totally that old. So I don't want to overstate it here, right?
Right in the middle.
Yeah, right in the middle. But, you know, I read with interest when you were talking about venues like Gilman Street, saying, you know, screw it, Green Day. You know, you were one of us, and now you're not, because you're too big. And I'm wondering if it's a generational attitude, because where we're based here in Minnesota, we obviously have First Avenue in Minneapolis. And there, and again, this might be a different version, a rosier version. I never want to say revisionist history, but a rosier version of history. And we look at bands that have come through there, particularly Minnesota bands, and I'm going to leave Prince out, because he's his own fortress, anomaly, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. But let's look at someone like Soul Asylum, which obviously got its start here in Minnesota, played the 7th Street Entry, moved up to the main room at 7th Avenue, and then broke big. And I thought there was almost more from a musical standpoint of civic pride. Like, here's a band from Minnesota, done good. And we were kind of excited. It doesn't mean we liked all their poppy songs when they became good, but we didn't seem like they had sold out per se. So getting back to the generational thing, do you think it's a difference in era, a difference in how different generations perceive the bands that they grew up listening to?
I don't know about like chronologically, but it definitely varies geographically for sure. You know, I think one of the things that really scared a lot of local scenes was when Nirvana broke, Seattle became sort of like a hotspot for record companies. You know, they were looking for the next Nirvana and the next Kurt Cobain, but then they started looking for the next Seattle. And there were some people like in Berkeley who had built their own, you know, scene, and they were very protective of it. They didn't want it to just to be ransacked like it happened in Seattle. So, but you know, there are like examples of cities where there aren't as like hot of scenes where it's not as big of an issue. Like again, Jimmy Eat World, just being from Arizona, it sounded like they're locally, people were pretty happy for them, actually. You know, it wasn't like they had a really strong local music scene where they thought like, oh, this, we could lose all of this, all the work we've done. It sounded like there was no main venue. There wasn't like a Gilman Street. There wasn't a CBGB. It was like wherever they could have shows. Sometimes it was at like a pastor's church on Saturday nights they could do shows, or like some back bar or something like that. So they weren't as protective of their own community. So it seemed like they could just relax and just be happy for their hometown boys who made it big, you know?
The other thing I was thinking about in advance of this interview today, you know, let's use Gilman Street as an example. What the promoters there should have done, not that they ever thought to ask me, right? But I give unsolicited advice every now and then. They should have done what Doug West and I understand did with the Troubadour in LA in the 70s. He said, all right, you can play here. But he had him sign something. If ever you make it big and come back through LA, you got to play here first before you go to the, you know, the Forum, or before you go to Dodger Stadium. So they get, he could get a little taste of the financial goods before they went for the following night. It was an interesting arrangement, I thought. Yeah. As you did your research, you know, you talk about Kurt Cobain, who obviously struggled, I think it's fair to say, with a number of issues, but I think success was one of them. Did you, kind of a twofold question here, did you find one example of somebody who dealt very well with the transition from being at a certain level to going into the stratosphere? And conversely, was there someone who really struggled and maybe in hindsight wished they hadn't taken the money from the big labels?
I don't know that, that there is an example of somebody who did well with it, because everybody that I talked to, really, there was some growing pains. And you know, the thing is, like, I remember Jim from At the Drive-In told me, he's like, I wish there were more mentors in the music industry, because nobody really gives you a roadmap for how to become famous. And even if we're not talking about great levels of fame, a band like At the Drive-In, you know, like they were 24 and all of a sudden they're on MTV and they're on the cover of all the weeklies wherever they go. And people are giving them drugs and alcohol, and it's just hard to hold it together. So I think one thing that every story in this book has in common is that, like, I don't think anybody dealt with that transition very well, because it's hard. It's hard for anybody to do, let alone like a 22-year-old kid. Nobody really gives you, there's no guidebook on how to become famous. So I really truly can't think of an example where I was like, wow, that person really handled it well. You know, it's hard.
Do you think some adapted over time?
Yeah. And you know, like, I think maybe Jimmy World is like the example that's the most sort of down to earth, because they did grind for a long time and they were humbled. They had a lot of humbling experiences. And then weirdly, with that single with the middle, they just became really big. But I think they probably had a sense in their heads that, like, this could go away at any moment, because they had seen what it was like playing to just a few hundred people every night and really getting dropped by your label. So they knew, they at that point they had like been battle worn by the, but it was, it sounds crazy because they were only like 25, but they had gone through some like ups and downs. And I think they were, had more realistic expectations for it.
So your book Sell Out, we're talking with Dan Ozzy, by the way. Your book Sell Out chronicles 94 to 2007. So if I'm doing the math right, we're dealing with what, 14 to 27 years ago, that window. Given the changes in how we consume music, you know, whether it's Amazon, Spotify, whatever, we are seeing the resurgence, I guess, of vinyl, and that's great. Do you see a movement like this coming along in the future, whether it's punk or otherwise?
It's really hard to say, because I don't think that, like, I think that the role of A&R has changed. Wherein, in the time that I'm documenting, I think A&R people would take a look at a band that they like, and maybe they would see some potential in it and say, yeah, like, this is a band that I think has a sound that we could sell to people. Over the years, with the addition of the internet into the equation, it's become much different. And I think that the role has changed in that A&Rs will kind of look at what a band has already built. They'll look at their numbers. You know, they have X amount of TikTok followers and they have X amount of streams on Spotify, and we could give them X amount of money and then we could make X profit off of it. And so I feel like it's more numbers driven than gut feelings. I mean, like, you read so many stories from these A&R guys in my book, and they just talk about, the first time I ever saw this band, I knew they could be the next Beatles or whatever it is. And I don't know if that really exists anymore. So it seems unlikely that an A&R is just going to take a chance on a band just because they see something in them, you know?
Yeah, again, it's somewhat ironic that, you know, and it's not just limited to the music business. I see it in different forms of business where people want you, if you're looking for a partnership, which essentially a record label and an artist is a partnership. Now, these days, the person with the money, if you will, is looking for someone to bring them so much more. And I think, well, okay, if I have that already, why do I need you?
Right, for sure.
Now, the flip side is in the record industry, it could help expand that and get these bands, you know, a national or international following and let them, you know, make money on the tours. Because I think the bands still, am I right that the bands still make the majority of their money through publishing rights and from touring as opposed
to, right. But the touring has gotten such that, you know, a lot of bands have to stay on the road for a lot longer than they probably would like to, because it is their like primary source of income. I think, you know, if you were to look at an artist's income split from 1994 and now, it would look a lot different, because you'd have, you know, I don't know, 30% on the road, 30% through your album sales, 30% through publishing or something like that. And now the slice of the pie that is album sales has gotten so much smaller. Sure. That the percentage for being on the road is greater. So then it just behooves bands to stay on the road for so long. But yeah, so the proportions have like just completely shifted over the years, for sure.
In the waning minutes we have, I want your opinion. I alluded to it earlier that, you know, we've seen what I think is fair to say, to some extent, a resurgence in the interest in vinyl records. Records, that's what I used to love to buy, you know? You're a little too young probably to remember going to the record store and getting records, CDs and cassettes maybe? But
I mean,
do you think...
I got them all, just for the record.
Excellent. No pun intended, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. but do you see the resurgence in vinyl as being kind of not a game changer necessarily, but something that could move the needle in a different way that these record companies did not intend, not necessarily didn't intend, but did not anticipate 5 or 10 years ago?
No, it's actually worse, because there is an increased interest in vinyl, and there's an increased interest in putting it out. However, the manufacturers have been shrinking over the last years. So really, in the United States, there are like 3 vinyl printing plants.
Oh my.
And I'm trying to put a record out right now, and the turnaround time is like 7 months, because what happens is it gets throttled by, you know, when a label wants to do a Harry Styles record for Urban Outfitters, and, or they want to do like the soundtrack for, you know, some movie that's like a cult, like a Babysitter, what is that movie? I don't know. But like, you know, just like some kitsch 80s soundtrack they want to reissue on vinyl. And that, and then Record Store Day just puts another big throttle on it. And so it's really hard for labels to make money off of the records. And I feel like all of the friends that I know that work in indie labels, they're doing so much work to make vinyl for their bands. and the profit margins are smaller than ever, and the turnaround times are so crazy. And all the bands that I know have had some issue with releasing the vinyl on time. You see it all the time where even on the release day of the album, yeah, like you can go listen to it on Spotify, but the vinyl actually might be another 2 months because it's just stuck in, you know, pressing plant hell behind the new, I don't know, Halsey vinyl that kids are going to buy but not actually listen to, you know. So it's just so frustrating for indie bands who could be making a lot of money off of this resurgence and interest, but there's just like all these things in their way.
And what I would think to build a new manufacturing plant is not cheap for these record manufacturers.
It's not cheap, and for them the profit margins are very thin as well. And and the idea that it could be a fad, I'm sure, is a scary factor. And if you were going to open if you're like, okay, there's a big interest in vinyl, maybe it's time to open a pressing plant. I'm guessing that you must have it in the back of your head that, like, by the time I get this plant going and hire people and get my clients, the trend could be over.
Right. You know? That's so how I would look at it, for sure.
Right. As a business decision, it's you just have to recognize that it might not last forever. So yeah, I think it's been just really, it sounds great that there's a vinyl resurgence, but in reality, it's really difficult.
All right. As we wrap up, let's get back to the book Sell Out by Dan Ozzie. Give me your favorite takeaway as an author. Something maybe you didn't expect to learn as you got into your research and writing.
One of the unexpected consequences is that I feel like when I was a young person, I heard phrases like major label or A&R guy, and I had this like shadowy image in my head of some guy with a suit and a ponytail and you know, a limo and a Rolex, and but it's just sort of like a vague enemy in your mind. That's how I was like sort of trained. But as I was writing the book, and as I had more jobs in the corporate world, and as I got older, I just like understood that the people who worked at these labels, one, were actual people, you know, they were real life people with names, and I talked to them for the book. And, but also too, a lot of times it was just people who really did like these bands and they wanted to help them. You know, granted, I'm sure there are some like shiesty people in the music industry for sure. But, you know, in a lot of cases, it was just guys who grew up in bands and maybe they grew up with Green Day or whatever. And they just actually wanted to help these types of bands. It didn't always work out, obviously. But I kind of like loosened my angry grip on my interpretation of what a major label is all about.
Fantastic. The book is Sell Out. He is Dan Ozzie, the author. I highly recommend it. And Dan, thanks so much for taking time to chat with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.